Hi, I'm Siskoid.
And I'm Dr. G.
Welcome to the second episode of Kung Fu Friday, a show that explores the best of Asian action cinema and hopes to inspire you to discover some awesome flicks from the other side of the world. Unless you live on that side of the world, of course. KFF is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. We haven't churned out these as quickly as we thought we would. We've been kind of busy, Dr. G.
Yeah, I've been moving and things like that, so I couldn't quite commit as much time as I could.
And on my end, I've had like improv tournaments and vacation time. I've been away like every weekend, which it doesn't seem like it's been much of a problem if you look at my network output. But, you know, some meetings are a little harder to set up because of that. But we're back. We're here. And even though Kung Fu Friday is not necessarily a weekly show, you'll get your dose from here to Christmas every so often. And each episode, we'll explore a basic theme. It might be an era, a director, a particular action star, a country, a style, anything really. And we'll pick two films to showcase that theme. Our double feature this week stars the one and only Bruce Lee. You excited about this?
Oh, this is... Bruce Lee's the gateway for everybody in some ways to the martial arts, at the very least since the 70s. And I'm so excited. I'm so, so excited. I love both of these movies that we're going to be talking about today.
He is iconic. So when people think of a martial artist or a martial arts star, they have that image in their minds of him bare-chested with the black pants, maybe the nunchucks, you know. There's something very... And a lot of people have imitated that. So we've seen pseudo-Bruce Lees over the years. A few notes about Bruce Lee, just so people can get a handle on his personal history. It might surprise people to know that he didn't make very many martial arts films. Barely five, in fact, though, because his father was a Chinese opera star, he did appear in some 20 films as a child. Those aren't really considered part of his canon. He moved to the U.S. at 18 and concentrated on martial arts rather than movies. But getting discovered at a 1964 exhibition led him to getting the role of Kato on the Green Hornet TV show, which I think Americans mostly discovered him through that. And after its cancellation, though himself trained in Wing Chun, he developed Jeet Kune Do, an efficient, styleless style, and he started teaching, some would say controversially, to non-Chinese students. Getting only supporting roles in Hollywood, he returned to Hong Kong and signed with Golden Harvest to star in two films, The Big Boss and Fist of Fury, on the strength of which he was given complete control over a third, called The Way of the Dragon, which introduced Chuck Norris to moviegoers. For good or ill. He then started filming Game of Death, but an opportunity came from the States to make an English-language martial arts film, so he took it. That's Enter the Dragon. It would be the film he would become best known for. But tragedy struck 3 weeks before the film's premiere. Bruce Lee dies of an allergic reaction to medicine given him for a cerebral edema in July of 1973 at the impossible age of 32. A legend in his own time. I think you'd agree. Game of Death would be finished without him and released posthumously years later, and Golden Harvest would go through a batch of lookalikes with similar names, Bruce Lee, Bruce Lai, Bruce Lee, but wouldn't capture the kind of lightning in a bottle again until it made stars of Jackie Chan, Sammo Hung, and Jet Li, some of whom appeared in, doing stunt work in Bruce Lee films this early on, including some of the films we'll be discussing today. So how did you discover Bruce Lee? I mean, we say he's the gateway for everyone, but there has to be a moment.
Mine came in college, and it really was with Enter the Dragon. I have two really good friends who are really my best friends since high school and college, and we really got into a Bruce Lee all together at the same time, and it was this movie and just how it's shot. And I mean, we'll talk a little more about it, but Enter the Dragon was my sort of like Bruce Lee gateway. Until then, I think more than anything, I'd seen a lot more of reference to Bruce Lee than anything else. I think I might have seen him in the James Garner movie Marlowe, where he has a brief role as a basically a heavy. But for the most part, that was about it. I was about to say probably the Batman 66 Green Hornet crossover two-parter, but I think I saw that much later. So but it's definitely Enter the Dragon was the first one to really pull me in. And we'll talk, like I said, we'll talk a little later about its influence. Huh? So how about you, Siskoid? What was your first experiences with Bruce Lee?
Like you, I think it's more a question of references to him. Like Bruce Lee was someone my parents knew, someone that was referenced not only in media, but, you know, around the house or whenever people talked about martial arts or even Chinese stars, it was always Bruce Lee. They were all, you know, Bruce Lee was this character of a man that perhaps I'd never even seen on screen, but everyone knew who he was. You know, if you did any sort of karate moves in the schoolyard or whatever, you were playing at being Bruce Lee and you were doing the cooing and the, you know, the screaming that he does. So you had that image in your mind. And I'm not quite sure when I first saw him, probably the Batman 66 crossover with Green Hornet, or perhaps even the Green Hornet episodes on Nickelodeon or something that I might have caught. But I can't say, I assume there must be a moment, but there was no real moment that I can point to. It's like Bruce Lee always existed, especially in the 70s when I grew up. You know, Bruce Lee was just a ubiquitous thing. It was like, you know, everyone knows who Bruce Lee is, just like everyone kind of knew who Uri Geller was, you know, the spoonbender guy. So it was one of those 70s things that it seemed to be in the zeitgeist, and you knew who he was without ever seeing him. So I saw Enter the Dragon relatively late, and then got into his other films. Yeah, there's no real moment for me except the fact that, you know, Bruce Lee is the prototype of the real person, but the prototype for the Deadly Hands of Shang-Chi, a Master of Kung Fu, you know, that all that Kung Fu craze stuff that I was exposed to in the 70s and 80s really all stems from him.
Yeah.
More than other Kung Fu stars, you know. He was like the one that made it to the mainstream and became an American icon as much as a Chinese one.
Well, yeah, and that's, I think that's probably the most important aspect of it too, is that, you know, I think in our previous episode we talked about sort of like the 70s Kung Fu craze that kind of hit the U.S., but he really brought it to the U.S. first. I mean, those films were already existing in Asia, but it's sort of that hunger that he brought when we, because Enter the Dragon was such a critical success around the world. Many were considered one of the best movies of 73 at the time. So, which is a lot to say for a movie that's pretty straightforward, just action for the most part. And it's funny, I was thinking a lot about this when we were, we were prepping for this. And since I grew up more through the 80s than the 70s. I'm really kind of late 70s, born in a little, very late second half and late half of the 70s. So I have less memory of that, but much more of the 80s. For me, 80s was, it was the dominance of the ninjas were the thing in American culture when it came to martial arts. And so for me, coming to Kung Fu and Chinese martial arts was really something that occurred for me in the 90s when I was in high school and starting to branch out into like watching foreign films. And then that's where I really got into Bruce Lee. Also, I think I definitely in early college went through, I've mentioned before, like my studying martial arts phase, at which point I was like then not only just studying martial arts, but like voraciously reading about them too. And Bruce Lee's, the Tao of Jeet Kune Do, his book is one of the ones prominently on my bookshelf still to this day. So, and it's that his philosophical end of it too that I thought was very interesting. But yeah, he's really that sort of the start of it and really bringing it in. I would say him and then David Carradine with Kung Fu was the other big one.
And if I'm not mistaken, I think Bruce Lee was a teacher of David Carradine. So,
Well, he was supposed to have that role. He was originally supposed.
Oh yeah, that's right. That's something he developed.
Yeah,
right?
It was supposed to be called The Warrior. And they didn't pick him because he was too Chinese. They didn't really feel that like it would have legs as a 70s TV show with a Chinese lead that basically isn't doing a Mr. Moto or a Charlie Chan horrible stereotypical role. So he always had been, like you said, relegated to basically supporting roles at that time. His leaving to go to start his basically movie career, the Kung Fu TV series was the sort of like the straw that broke the camel's back on that one. He was in Hong Kong and discovered that basically in Hong Kong, the Green Hornet TV show was called the Kato Show because they saw him, you know, and really put him up front as the real star of that show. And that's where, so he had a pretty much a built-in fan base when he came into China to film his movies, and that's where it took off. And then, but then Enter the Dragon was the big Western crossover movie with, you know, Western production and Asian production, production company, and Fred Weintraub, who, ironically, Fred Weintraub is the producer behind the Kung Fu TV series, who had at first sort of like kind of dropped him in the first place, but then kind of came back to him hat in hand when they saw his success in his first couple of movies with martial arts movies in China.
Part of the reason to go to Hong Kong and get starring roles in films was to up his cred so he could come back to the States and, you know, like proof of concept. And it did work, since Enter the Dragon is, although it is sort of a shared story between three stars, that worked. He proved he had a non-screen presence that could carry a film, and he got that deal with Enter the Dragon, which, you know, kind of led to one of the things we talk about on the show, is the confusion that results from the translated names. So that, you know, when, once it comes to the States, the movies get different titles. Yeah. Of course, Enter the Dragon is the actual title of the film, but it would lead to, say, The Way of the Dragon being called Return of the Dragon, because after the success of Enter the Dragon, then they're going to release the previous films as if they'd come after, trying to trade on the dragon name. We picked the two best films, I think, that he ever made.
Enter the Dragon is my pick. There's so much. Over at my own podcast, the Pulp to Pixel Podcasts, the opening stinger sound for us is Williams from this movie.
Man, you come right out of a comic book.
When he, I thought, very coolly refers to Mr. Handman as someone who comes right out of a comic book.
That was fun watching it again and say, oh, yeah, that's the Pulp to Pixels stinger. Yeah. For my part, I picked Fist of Fury, which I think is one of the more solid efforts. I think plot-wise, it's probably the most solid of all his films. That's why I picked that one. Whereas I think the ones we did not pick are either fairly forgettable except for Bruce Lee, or in the case of, say, Way of the Dragon, has a great final fight, but really tests your patience the rest of the way.
Roper, Williams, and Lee, the deadly three, penetrate the secret chambers of an evil island empire.
What do you know about Han?
He lives like a king on that island. Totally self-sufficient.
A fortress without walls, protected by an invincible army that needs no ordinary weapons. This is Enter the Dragon, the first martial arts film produced by a major Hollywood studio. John Saxon is Roper. He was in it for the money. U.S. karate champion Jim Kelly as Williams. He was there because he had no choice. Black Belt Hall of Fame, undisputed martial arts champion, and international film star Bruce Lee. His job was to get them out alive.
I'm hoping you'll join us, represent us in the United States.
You want me to join this?
Roper, Williams, and Lee. Just when they think they've broken the secret of the island, they find there is no escape from the inscrutable Han. Warner Brothers presents Enter the Dragon, where the world's greatest martial arts athletes meet the ultimate challenge with the most ancient and deadly of weapons, the human body. Enter the Dragon, from Warner Brothers.
Let's get into it. Enter the Dragon.
Enter the Dragon, release date of July 26, 1973 in Hong Kong, but made it to the States August 19th the same year. Directed by Robert Klaus, with, of course, obviously, Bruce Lee as the star actor, but supported by John Saxon and Jim Kelly, with Robert Wall and Bolo Young as villains. For anyone who's a fan of a lot of martial arts movies that would follow, you will see Bolo Young appear many, many, many times.
Most prominently in Bloodsport, I think. That's where people would know him from, yeah.
Yeah, and he basically has his dig on Bruce Lee, where in Bloodsport he beats up a guy clearly aping Bruce Lee style. Amazing soundtrack by Lolo Schifrin.
Mm-hmm.
Same composer for the Mission Impossible theme and the Mission Impossible series. And this movie was in many ways an unqualified success. It had a original budget of $850,000 and had a worldwide take at 90 million when all said and done. So that's about as unqualified a success in a movie production as is. And as we said, really launched the martial arts kung fu phase in the 70s and then well beyond that. This movie, it's often equated to having a lot of like James Bond themes to it, which you see with the sort of like international spy drama. With a little bit of Mr. Han being very much a Dr. No-like villain,
yeah.
But also is, you'd have to say, is unbelievably copied and homaged throughout movies, even to the point of the entire Mortal Kombat video game series is really shares a great deal of theme with this movie in particular of the martial arts contest. As you mentioned also, we'd also see a number of Kung Fu stars who will become famous in their own rights, particularly Jackie Chan, who in many interviews I've seen has discussed how meeting Bruce Lee was like one of the greatest things in his life. He even gets to do a little stunt double work for him, and Bruce Lee breaks his neck in it, so it must be the high point of his of his career. It's like, did you get murdered by Bruce Lee on film? Yes, it was the best thing that ever happened. And Sammo Hung, who a longtime collaborator and friend of Jackie Chan as well, he's actually the guy he's fighting in Bruce Lee fights in the opening sequence of the movie. So it's also a movie, I think, and this is something that will definitely bear some discussion, is this is also his really final film, as he dies under a lot of, at first, fairly mysterious circumstances, but later it shown to be, after autopsy, that it was a drug interaction. His death will spawn a great deal of martial arts folklore, in essence, and urban legend that would follow, tragically, even follow his son to his untimely death in The Crow, Brandon Lee, at roughly the same age and around the same time. So this is a, in many ways, an influential film.
For people who have never seen it, and we're not going to spoil every beat necessarily, but what is this movie about?
All right. So this movie is about Bruce Lee's character of Lee, who is a graduate, as we were, of the Shaolin Temple. And he is approached by British intelligence to take part in Mr. Han's martial arts competition that he holds. And Mr. Han is a mysterious figure holed up in a fortress island that he owns, and also connected to white slavery and drug trade throughout Asia. They want to get someone into the inside to help confirm that the drug trade is taking part on that island so that they can actually move in, because he's, as they kind of establish, the island sits in this sort of political intersection in the Chinese waters. So it's not quite under Chinese or British influence or Russian influence really at that time too, where it is. So it's kind of, he sits in this sort of political dead zone, and they need like sort of hard proof before they're able to move on him and sort of break his criminal empire. Along the way though, as Bruce accepts, specifically after he learns that his sister had been murdered by the bodyguard of Mr. Han. So he's got a little skin in the game on this one. We're also introduced to two other characters, Williams, played by Jim Kelly, and Roper, played by John Saxon, both who are old Vietnam War buddies, who both themselves are also invited to this competition, and for their own, in many ways, their own reasons. I think Jim Kelly is probably really the only one who really showing up to actually prove his mettle as a martial artist the most, whereas Roper is definitely there to make a buck, as we're quickly established that he's pretty much a gambling addict. We get a lot of moves of intrigue and definitely great combat scenes that eventually does culminate in a massive raid on the island by British forces, Chinese and British forces, and final showdowns between Bruce Lee, John Saxon, and a bunch of baddies, including Mr. Han. And that's pretty much it. As a plot, it's a very, like, by-the-numbers, straightforward plot. I've never felt, there isn't a lot of, I feel like, a lot of sleight of hand or moves in it. It's, you know, everyone's motivation is pretty crisp and straightforward, and it goes from A to B, but it just does it so masterfully that you don't miss anything or notice that it's just, this is pretty standard. Fight bad guys plot.
I think there's an extra layer to, of course, the martial arts tournament as a setting is one of the, I'll use the word laziest, plot devices for a martial arts film, because it, you know, that provides ample reason to see fights. And that's 80% of why you're there. to see that. So it works that way. But it's always very satisfying, I think, more than in a video game kind of way. You know, seeing those matchups and seeing different styles spar, it doesn't matter if that's the conceit. But the extra layer, I think, is that they actually, you know, Bruce Lee is sent on this mission, but he's also got a personal stake in it. When he goes to the island, it's with revenge in mind, especially in the way they, because theatrically, the film was shown without certain scenes. On the DVD that we get, the special edition, is the one where Bruce Lee insisted on getting certain scenes in, and that complete film was his vision that he sort of imposed on Robert Klaus. So he's the one that filmed that first part. Bruce Lee basically directed that initial fight with Sammo Hung. And all the more, you know, Zen martial arts speak that was not in the theatrical cut that we would never have seen because we were either not born or babies.
Yeah.
So that layer of it where, you know, where Bruce or his character Lee, I mean, it seems they use the same name. It's almost bizarre, just as Bolo Young is also called Bolo. He goes to that island. He's got a mission to fulfill, but he's also got that rage inside him and a sort of, they talk about it just enough for me to feel it. The idea that he's going against the principles of Shaolin, that he's using his martial arts to kill.
Yeah.
Because these aren't fights where the goons wind up insensate and just like knocked out. There's this whole thing where he steps on necks or whatever's happening under the camera, mm-hmm. killing people. And you see it in his face. He's doing the Bruce Lee screams that go with his moves. But there's pain in his face. That's supposed to be the pain of having taken a life and knowing he must get revenge for his sister. And at the same time, this goes against all the great principles of Shaolin. Do you feel that when watching the
film? Yeah, in fact, actually, one of my favorite parts of, and this is something we see also in Fist of Fury as well, is that when he does kill in his movies, Bruce Lee's character always has this look of like horrified sadness at what he had done and what he has to do. And in particular, in this movie, you see it the most when his fight with O'Hara, the man responsible for the death of his sister, although she did die by her own hand, she killed herself rather than be, well, basically assaulted.
Turned into a sex slave, yeah.
You know, so he's responsible, but he also didn't kill O'Hara in that fight until O'Hara up the game by breaking bottles and bringing weapons into what was ostensibly supposed to be a hand-to-hand fight. In fact, Bruce had his back turned and walked away because he knew he had defeated him. And yet, when O'Hara comes at him with the bottles, that's when he ends him. And he does with his, what I like to call his jumping, like, rib crush, where he crushes the person. You do see it in his face, and it's this sort of like, it's a real mix. It's an anguish over what he's had to do, sadness over that this, you know, the death of his sister has led him to this, something that does really betray his principles, something he does establish in the director's cut at the very beginning, you know, as a sort of not only a philosophical conversation with the abbot of the Shaolin Temple, where he shows his understanding of the deeper philosophies of his martial arts form, but he himself also, you know, shows that he is also training another person as well, and the young boy that he's also giving spiritual and sort of philosophical lessons to as well. So I definitely, yeah, I see his anguish in it, and I see that there's so much complexity. And for, you know, a character who throughout the movie really doesn't have a heavy load of dialogue. You know, he does a lot of this movie with his physicality and his face, you know, his yipping sounds and his sort of his version of the Kia. But it's definitely Williams and Roper who are really carrying the movie from a, I would say, a straightforward, like, dialogue acting point of view.
Mm-hmm. As native English speakers, I guess. Yeah. They're an odd addition to the formula because it feels like, to me, the film, as written, it's trying to be several exploitation films at once. So it's a martial arts picture, but it's also a blaxploitation picture, thanks to Jim Kelly's presence. Although this is his first film, he would go on to become Black Belt Jones a year later.
I love that movie.
That's a fun, yeah, it's a fun camp. Also iconic film, you know, in its way. And, you know, Saxon is playing this, like the con man kind of flick. Crime, con man, heist,
yeah.
Picture kind of hero. So it's like heroes from three different exploitation genres meet up, yeah. this tournament. Each has their strand. I mean, Jim Kelly in this never even has an interaction with Bruce Lee.
Yeah, no, they don't have a conversation or anything. No. They, I mean, except for being like a nod on the boat, the junk they take from Hong Kong to Mr. Han's island. Roper and Bruce Lee do. It's funny, that lack of sort of dialogue from Bruce Lee and the sort of the other, the two sort of American actors, basically, who take the more heavy lifting of the sort of, like I said, the dialogue lead. There's also, I feel like, a great economy in the way that's shot. Not to say that Bruce Lee doesn't have his good acting turns, but he also doesn't have really always good acting turns. It's really that physicality that he brings that is really his greatest strength, and he played to it throughout the movie. He's very much, as the lead of this movie, is very much this almost silent presence.
And I think they draw that contrast at one point in very much an exploitation style by contrasting interactions between the three leads and the prostitutes that are on the island. Mm-hmm. I thought that was like a clever way to use that exploitation trope,
yeah,
which is just, you know, just basically a little titillation there that you expect from these kinds of films. For example, so Williams picks four or five women. He's that guy.
Yeah. You mean the guy I wish I was?
You know, he's slick. He's cool. Of course, he's a blaxploitation star. So that's got to be part of the, you know, the Shaft,
yeah,
kind of charisma has to go into it. And then Saxon, who plays Roper looks at the prostitutes offered and he picks the madam.
Yeah.
He picks the older woman with whom he has sort of a relationship through the rest of the film. It's like he's a more mature man. That it's not about sex for him. It's about something else, you know?
Quality, I think, is what it was. It was sort of like, he was offered everything at the bar and definitely went from the top to the top shelf for what he chose.
Exactly. He's that character. And then Bruce Lee, his character refuses any prostitutes. He's not interested in that kind of thing. You know, he's not getting drunk and he's not overeating and he's not having sex on this island. He's focused. He's silent. He's a monk.
Yeah.
Basically. So through that scene, you get really a sense of who they are, even though they're playing, let's say, you know, tropes or archetypes from these different kinds of films. Mm-hmm. But it feels right. I thought that was like an interesting way to differentiate the characters through that particular scene. But, you know, I wish that John Saxon's agent wasn't so good, because originally in the script, Williams, the Jim Kelly character, was the one to survive, let's say, was the one that would be the main guy next to Bruce Lee instead of Roper. So Roper would have not have had many scenes with Bruce Lee or no scenes with Bruce Lee. And then Jim Kelly, who was a stronger martial artist, would have been Bruce Lee's partner to the end.
Yeah.
So I kind of wish that's how it would have gone. But of course, Jim Kelly was a no-name and John Saxon was an established actor. So, you know, it fell a different way.
And, you know, not to put too fine a point in it, it was like not just established actor, but he's a good actor too, you know?
In his mind, in interviews, he thought he was the star of this film.
Oh.
He thought this was a John Saxon film.
Oh, well, it kind of ends up in some ways. I mean, there's many ways where it is a John Saxon film, because Williams' character, Jim Kelly's character, Williams, is, you know, he doesn't have... There's not a lot of like moral turns for him where he has to really have a kind of, you know, a struggle of morality throughout it. He's who he is from jump. Whereas we see with Roper, there's a question of it. You know, Mr. Han himself even senses that and offers Roper a place within the organization, which, you know, Roper sort of takes more out of a sense of like self-preservation more than anything else. But really, only when confronted with the idea that, like, you know, a buddy of his is killed by Mr. Han. Oh, spoilers. that is only really when he turns on Mr. Han. So he gets this ambiguity to where he's going to end on that, you know, which in many ways makes him a much more complex character. It's funny, too, because I think there's a definitely like almost like an inverted pyramid of acting skill and martial arts skill, you know, watching them all fight. You know, Jim Kelly is a very impressive fighter, and Saxon, not to say he isn't a good fighter, he's a black belt in karate himself, so it's not that he was without his own chops as a martial artist, but it's clearly Bruce Lee, you can just see it at how he moves in those sequences, you know, is really the one who's got the highest prowess there, but, you know, Saxon's the one really with the best acting chops of all of them. So it's definitely an interesting mix. And, you know, it is Bruce Lee's movie, but I think without those other two, not going to sustain itself the way. I remember the Roper and Jim Kelly parts as much as I remember the Bruce Lee parts. Because the Bruce Lee parts for me are always the fight scenes. And aside from some of the scenes at the Shaolin Temple and then what's some of my favorite sequences on the boat, which we're definitely going to be talking about later. It's that sort of, like I said, inverted pyramids of martial arts skill and acting skill that in the end it's almost out of the three of them, we get a whole sort of single action hero out of the mix of the three of them.
The real genre is Bruce Lee's, except that the villain is very much a Bond villain. You said it. And I mean, the metal hands and it's sort of the lair from Man with a Golden Gun, and he's got Blofeld's cat. I mean, they're very overtly playing with the Bond villain tropes, doing little twists on it in Mr. Han. So at the same time, it becomes like a James Bond knockoff. So the dragon, Enter the Dragon, the dragon is Bruce Lee, and the dragon is sort of the equivalent to 007.
Yeah.
You know, when you say 007 and you say the dragon, anything with the dragon in it, you know, has a link to Bruce Lee.
Yeah.
It's either a ripoff of Bruce Lee, the story of the real life story of Bruce Lee, you know, something Bruce Lee-ish has the word dragon in it. So it becomes his nickname from this point on.
Yeah.
It's all these exploitation genres. It also becomes the spy thriller.
Yeah.
But it is an exploitation film. So I want to be clear on this, that to me, although Enter the Dragon is iconic and it's got set pieces that are very memorable, the final fight in the Hall of Mirrors, for example, the level of fighting is very strong for Bruce Lee, and I think it's one of the better productions as far as just the look of it. It is still an exploitation film. I mean, there was this famous fight between Bruce Lee and the writer of the film, Michael Allen, who by all accounts seems to be an asshole, because Bruce Lee wanted to have all that philosophical stuff in it, right, which he eventually managed to get into the film. But the scriptwriter wanted nothing to do with that. And he told Bruce Lee, you know, this is just, stop fighting it. This is just a silly little film. This is a nothing film. And being told that by when he's trying to make his mark on cinema, on martial arts, and on making a film that will actually transmit his beliefs and thoughts and vision of what martial arts is and why it is a good thing, being told that became a problem. And as a revenge for Bruce Lee's interference, Allen would rewrite the script and put as many R sounds in Bruce Lee's dialogue because that was a difficult letter to pronounce in his accent. And so just to make it even tougher and make him look bad. I mean, that's terrible.
Yeah.
And I'm sure Bruce Lee was a difficult person to work with, very demanding. And I think that's what happens when someone is at the top of their game. They become very demanding of others. And, you know, they want to hit a certain level of proficiency and don't suffer fools gladly, you know. But, you know, that goes beyond, I think. So when I look at the film, I can't help but think that, yeah, it was written by somebody who just like knocks these out,
yeah,
schlock writer kind of person. And it's not like Robert Klaus, the director, is a big name director either. If you look at the rest of his work, it is also exploitation B-movie stuff. So in this case, I felt, I look at the film, I think, oh, the editing is kind of, there's too much air in this. The direction's not great. It really comes down to getting some great set pieces, some great action in there, and the charisma of the stars to make this one properly shine.
And there's a lot to be said about that, too. I mean, I think their lead villain, Mr. Han, is non-English speaking, had to phonetically memorize all of his lines, which is why there's such a weird, stilted delivery that he gives throughout it. And which I always found was so fascinating about it, that he's just like, they just had to phonetically teach it to him for him to do it. But he's still a very like menacing presence throughout the movie as well. And the philosophical parts are, especially in the mirror sequence and the early discussion he has with the abbot, because those two sequences are bookends and connect to each other as a thread philosophically throughout the movie. But yeah, there was a lot, you know, that Bruce Lee had writing on this in many ways. You know, I wanted to take a second to talk about how, like, more than just that, though, the influence of this movie is also what I would say is the influence of the legend of Bruce Lee that arises out of this movie as well. Being, sadly, his last movie with his very untimely death, there was so much swirl of controversy about his death. From the fact that he, you know, died in the bedroom of one of the actresses. So there was, you know, there's some hints of him having potentially a extramarital affair while on the movie. The fact that he died of a drug interaction, always the specter of drugs. In the more fanciful ends of it, too, is the idea that, you know, he was killed by a secret technique known as DMAC, you know, a death touch technique, and the most fantastical of controversies and or conspiratorial theories around this movie. But I think also from when we talk about sort of kind of the legend of this, too, is the idea that also came up that during the filming, he took all comers. If someone challenged him to a fight, he did it. I don't know exactly how true all of those stories are, but I've heard, even when I was taking martial arts at the time, I was studying Aikido in college, and my sensei at the time, even he himself, had his own anecdotal story about like how cool and how powerful Bruce Lee was, and I believe there was a fair amount of also like potentially like beef between him and like Bolo Young during the filming of the movie, which is why, you know, they don't seem to have any fight scenes together. And Bolo Young is very surprisingly defeated by John Saxon, even though Bolo Young is like yoked AF and John Saxon not so much. But seriously, Bolo Young, that guy's huge. So
yeah, he's a mountain.
Yeah, so, you know, there was a lot of stories about how like Bolo was like, I'm better than you. And I think my favorite anecdote was to show how fast Bruce Lee was that it was either Bolo or someone else was kind of challenging him. And while he were waiting, Bruce Lee was sort of listening to this guy kind of rant about how cool, how good he is and how he could take him on. And the whole time he was sort of like his foot was sort of in a little puddle of paint left, you know, from production. And apparently he like kicked up so fast and tapped Bolo with it that he didn't notice, but then there was like a little paint spear next to him. Now, probably not true at all, but that's the kind of stories that came out of the filming of this movie and, you know, kind of follow the movie itself. And so more than anything, I think that's part of what leads to beyond just the strength of what you see on the the film itself is the things that swirl around it. You know, I think it's much like, the Shining and how things, you know, they talk about so many of the things and like all the hidden messages and all the ways that like Kubrick acted and stuff. That was as much what makes that movie great and enduring as what you actually see in the film itself.
Or Apocalypse Now. Yeah. A lot of these films that are troubled productions. And it's part of the Bruce Lee legend. I think that's part of the reason he, despite his pretty small output of films, was a legend. And he's the one that people think of first when they think of martial arts stars. Even though, you know, his films were not the best ever made in the genre. And he did not make as many films as many others did. But when he's on screen, you immediately get it. He is a star.
Yeah.
And I often say when I look at like some of the lesser films that when Bruce Lee is on screen, I'm watching. I'm riveted. As soon as they cut away to the guy he's talking to, I'm bored. There's a power there. There's a charisma.
Yeah.
We'll talk about some of the moves, the cool moves that happen in Enter the Dragon, but we'll keep that to the end because we just want to throw some of the coolest bits from the two films we've picked all together and then choose a move of the week. So we'll just take a small break now, and then we'll talk about Fist of Fury.
In 1984, I was 10 years old, and a strange light lit up the park behind my house. In the middle of the night, still in my pajamas, I ran to investigate. A strange machine sat brooding in the dark. I stepped inside and I was taken to a far-off galaxy, where I saw men, monsters, and gods fight and die. Join us again on the Marvel Superheroes Secret Wars and Beyond series, part of the Pulp to Pixel podcasts, where we will discuss each issue of the Secret Wars miniseries and their long-term impact on the characters who joined us on Battleworld and on those we left behind on the home front. Join us again on Battleworld. Return with us to our Secret Wars.
2011, the Irredeemable Shag and Aqua Rob Kelly teamed up to create the Fire & Water podcast. In 2016, they teamed up with Ryan Daly, The Franklins, and Siskoid to form the Fire & Water Podcast Network. A network built on teaming up needs a show about team-ups.
Marvel Team-Up.
Yes.
The Brave and the Bold?
You know it.
Marvel 2-in-1.
It's clobbering time.
DC Comics presents.
Of course.
Supervillain Team-Up?
Good idea.
Youngblood X-Force?
Technically.
FW Team-Up, coming this summer, only from the Fire & Water Podcast Network.
He's unstoppable, unbeatable, unbelievable. He's Bruce Lee, the master of karate, kung fu, delivering the Chinese connection. Bruce Lee, the Oriental superstar who exploded across the screens of America in the phenomenally successful Fists of Fury, is back to defend the honor of his nation and the love of his woman. Using his furious fists and superhuman strength, he breaks them up, smashes them down, and kicks them apart. Bruce Lee, the karate kung fu king, delivers the death blow of the Chinese connection.
So Fist of Fury, this one's from 1972. Americans will probably know it better as The Chinese Connection, which is also one of its titles, because when it was sent over to the States, that's the title they gave it, in part because his first film was called The Big Boss, but in the States they called it Fists of Fury. So then Fist of Fury becomes confusing if you've got fists and fist. So it became The Chinese Connection, probably due to the popularity of The French Connection, but it has nothing to do with that other film, so whatever. But Fist of Fury has, the director is Lo Wei. It stars Bruce Lee, Nora Miao, Tian Feng, and Robert Baker, who was one of Bruce Lee's students. And he plays the Russian, a Russian man mountain, a bit like Robert Wall had played a similar European character in Enter the Dragon. You can find it. This one is easy to find if you find the Bruce Lee box set called The Ultimate Collection. It has all the Golden Harvest films. So the only one that's missing really is Enter the Dragon. And of course, Fist of Fury is in that. So here's what happens in the film. It's 1908, Shanghai. It's occupied by the Japanese. Chen Zhen, I pronounce it as you wish, played by Bruce Lee, has just lost his master to mysterious circumstances, and he doesn't take it well. The Japanese take this opportunity to come to his school and insult the Chinese, which leads to a retaliation by Chen, in which he defeats the entire Japanese dojo. Then he discovers the Japanese were responsible for poisoning his master, and he goes on a rampage using his powerful fists and gift for disguise, which is, that's a fun bit, to uncover who was part of the conspiracy and kill them. Meanwhile, pressure is put on the Chinese police to capture the rogue martial artist and on his school to give him up. It all comes to a head when Chen returns to the Japanese compound to kill the Japanese governor, first defeating a Russian man-mountain in his service, and then the governor himself. Chen returns to his school only to find the Japanese have killed almost every student and the rest face arrest. So he chooses to give himself up to save them and the woman he loves. But rather than go to jail, he attacks the arrest party and is shot down sort of in a freeze frame. It's a story that might sound familiar because it's been retold a number of times with others in the role, most prominently by Jet Li in Fist of Legend, Jackie Chan in New Fist of Fury, and Donnie Yen in the Fist of Fury TV series. It's a role he reprises with a few more nods to Bruce Lee's career in Legend of the Fist, The Return of Chen Zhen, which I do recommend. And Chen Zhen was a real person. So this is not the, I mean, it's a fictionalized version where he goes on a rampage and kills everyone, but there was an actual Chen Zhen who lived in Shanghai at this time, who had a master who had been killed, you know, by the Japanese. After that, the details may be pretty different in actuality. So Fist of Fury, I picked it because though it has a certain, you know, it's not a location kind of film. It's on a set. It's on a back lot and a set, which is unusual for a Golden Harvest film. So it has a look that is more artificial and feels more like the Batman 66 or Green Hornet stuff, in a sense, especially since he's, you know, he's got disguises and some striking looks. I think like the funeral.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
The white suit that he wears is just as iconic as, you know, the yellow motorcycle costume from A Game of Death. And in any case, he finds a way. Bruce Lee will always find a way in both these films to strip down to the black pants and find nunchucks to use. That's the signature look, and I think it happens in both Enter the Dragon and in Fist of Fury, even if it's a little ridiculous that they come to it. Oh, I just found some nunchucks, you know. It's kind of funny that way. What did you think of this one?
I would have to say this is my second favorite of the Bruce Lee movies. I love to lovingly and mockingly, sometimes when things don't go right, just yell out into the sky, "Teacher!" And jump on it.
Zipu!
Or Zipu! It's funny, actually. This is the first time I watched, to prep for this, this was the first time I actually watched the original Cantonese language version of it. I've always watched the dub, overdub of it. So in the spirit of 70s badly dubbed Kung Fu movies, but I definitely did like it better as a movie. And it was nice to see a lot of faces I'd seen before in other martial arts films. I think specifically like the head, the new head of the school. I've seen him in a number of martial arts films and kung fu films as well. But I think this was a movie that definitely plays more to Bruce Lee's acting chops. At the very least, his facial acting chops and his ability to kind of do things. And like, as you mentioned, those undercover sequences, I'd forgotten about them. And when I was rewatching, I was like, those are actually pretty good. You know,
yeah, he plays a lot of comedy in that as well. So, you know, the simple-minded telephone repairman, for example. You know, or he plays an old man just, you know, watching. The disguise artist element is a lot of fun, and it brings a comedy to a film that is, you know, in essence, pretty dark.
Yeah.
And again, Bruce Lee's character does the like you said earlier, has to kill when he finds it repugnant, and you see that on his face. But it's a revenge story that for someone who feels the drive to get revenge for his master's death, all the while knowing that he is soiling his master's reputation by doing so. He knows his master would never have agreed to this course of action, and yet feels compelled to take revenge on the Japanese occupiers.
Well, and I think this is part of what's interesting, because it's, you know, I'm always finding as I watch these movies, especially with a very critical eye to really kind of review them, I often have a much different viewpoint of them. And as I watched, I was like, you know, he really puts his schoolmates in physical and mortal harm throughout this movie by his no consultation of anyone else decisions to kind of unilaterally make these decisions. And it's not just that he kills these people in revenge, but then like strings their bodies up almost, I would say almost serial killer style in some ways. So there's a part of it when I was watching, I was like, he's supposed to be the hero, right? Cause you know, I mean, that interpreter is disgusting beyond disgusting throughout that movie. Mm-hmm. But you know, the idea of him being like barehanded, murdered, and then strung up is still a little gruesome as an outcome. And yet, you know, heroes get away with a lot of stuff in movies, or more to the point, I'd say he's really an anti-hero in this one in many ways.
Yeah, a vigilante. Yeah. He's the Punisher. You know, he's a Chinese Punisher for sure. But at the same time, I can see why he would be seen as a sort of rebel fighter, because this is occupied China. So we have invaders. The Japanese are, of course, not portrayed in any kind of balanced way. They are straight up villains in this. it feels justified, especially if they killed the master, so that sort of weakened the school that might be too influential in the city. There's just politics in here that are glossed over because they're not really important to the plot. It's just context. But there's something very Batman about Bruce Lee's character in this, yeah. Not just because he fights, you know, those evildoers, but the whole disguise stuff. And, you know, it's more than just being physical and fighting. It's also, there's some cleverness to it.
Yeah, he's got some cunning.
Yeah, and he's got to discover who the big boss is and who actually, you know, he's solving a murder is what he's doing. It just so happens that everyone who participated in the murder at some point, you know, gets horribly murdered by martial arts.
Yeah, yeah. He kind of Dexters his way through this one.
Okay, yeah. It's not a perfect film. It still has some stripes of exploitation, which Golden Harvest did not do away with until much later in the 70s. But, you know, things that are anachronistic to me, I think it's supposed to portray the Japanese in a bad light more than anything, but the gratuitous stripper scene does not feel like this is 1908 at that point. So, I mean, and it's just a little bit of titillation.
Yeah, that was a very 70s titillating stripper sequence. I'd forgotten about it and I was watching it and I was like, oh, whoa, I don't remember this movie. So
yeah, I never remember that bit, but because it is so, you know, easy to jettison, that could have been cut out easily and probably in like TV edits probably was, you know, but it's just to show again that the Japanese are decadent, yes. I guess. And we also see their racism where they've got a park where the Chinese cannot enter that park, only foreigners, whether they be white or Japanese, they can enter, but, you know, the Chinese can't. So they show that the Chinese being a minority in their own city, in their own country.
Yeah.
And there, too, there's a very bad anachronism where a guy with a really fat 70s tie walks in.
Yes.
That's a bit of a flaw.
That sequence with at the park in particular, I think, is definitely the cornerstone of like the sort of what they're kind of saying, because this is supposed to be post the second Sino-Japanese War. And, you know, Japanese are basically an occupying force controlling this part of Shanghai. And, you know, the comments he gets, because that sign is not just no Chinese, it's no dogs and no Chinese.
Right.
And yet a couple with a dog goes through and the Sikh guard that stopped him from going into the park lets them go through. And what was it? The Japanese guy who kind of like taunts him says that if he behaves like a dog, they'll let him in. At which point I felt no remorse for the pummeling that guy received at the hands of Bruce Lee. It's very dicey in that sense, but I think it also illustrates the sort of position they were in, you know, that he's in at that moment. It's sort of, you know, that the title itself lays out that this is about a person, you know, filled with rage and for, you know, I would say in some cases, very justified reasons.
The Chinese films, as we'll see through this whole series of podcasts, Chinese films are not subtle about in their creation of villains.
Right.
You know, the worst offenses ever committed by villains will be in Chinese films. Chinese villains kill children, and I mean, it's Game of Thrones level stuff.
Yeah.
This isn't a surprise that the black hats in this are extremely black, mm-hmm. but in the case of the hero, even the hero is pushed to the dark side, really, in this. So the complexity is in the hero and what they must do and perhaps compromise of themselves when faced with such evil. Of course, to a Japanese audience, this would probably, the film appears very racist, you know, as a portrayal of the Japanese people. But that's not something that stays with me as I watch Fist of Fury.
Yeah.
These are an occupying force. It's not saying that a common Japanese citizen is evil. It's just these guys, this like corrupt and corrupting occupying force. So, you know, it's just like select few people that are obviously corrupt. So it doesn't, to me, it doesn't seem to be like attacking the Japanese in bulk. It's just these guys, and they're in a position to be corrupt, so it makes sense to me. And sort of selling out to European interests as well with the Russian.
Yeah.
This is actually a transposition of historical events in this, because if you've ever seen the Jet Li film Fury, it's pretty good, and it has some elements in common with this, because in Fury, Jet Li plays Chen Zhen's master as a younger man. So the master who's dead at the beginning of Fist of Fury is the main character in Fury.
Oh, okay.
And this is actually based on historical or folklore, but he fights a Russian fighter who called the entire Chinese people, sick men of Asia. Like, historically, that was a fight that Chen Zhen's master fought in the Fists of Fury and Fists of Legend, which is the same story, really. It's Chen Zhen who gets confronted with the sick men of Asia insult.
Yeah.
And, you know, goes to... Really, it's like dominoes are falling, because originally Chen Zhen doesn't know that his master's been murdered, although he really doubts the death. You know, they get insulted at their school. He goes to the other school against his master's or new master's advice, the school leader's advice, and he beats up on the dojo. And then there's retaliation, you know, if he'd only let it go. But he doesn't let the insult go, and then everything that happens after that is more or less a byproduct of his impulsive, you know, move. So, but that was originally, that was an insult that was made to Chen Zhen's master, not to Chen Zhen. So they sort of combined the two stories, the two historical or folkloric stories together to make Fist of Fury, which is remade so many times that that becomes the iconic folkloric story, but it's actually a combined tale.
That's actually very, very interesting. I mean, and as you mentioned too, it's like, you know, Jet Li, not only in playing that, but himself will then play Chen Zhen, of course, and like you said, in Fist of Legend. That's very fascinating. You know, it's interesting. I like how a lot of these take from definitely some historical callbacks and characters to them. But yeah, so that dojo sequence, I kind of feel like after that dojo sequence where one of them beats them all up in the form of Bruce Lee, that the retaliation is like the fact that all of his dojo mates have a lot of trouble, like, fighting back and at the same time, too, against the dojo is like, who is training them? And what special training did Bruce Lee get over those guys? Because he got the same training, yet is able to whoop on an entire dojo full of the Japanese students. But, you know, when the Japanese students show up, you know, their guys are hard pressed to hold their own against the same dojo guys who got beat up in the previous sequence.
But he's, you know, he's a genius.
Yeah, yeah.
So I can follow piano lessons with Mozart, but at the end of the day, he's always going to be better than I am, you know. And that's true of Bruce Lee. I think Bruce Lee himself is, it's a sort of physical genius, although he brings the philosophy to it, but he's a genius at what he does, and so will always outperform anyone else. So how is that possible? If Chen Zhen is like Bruce Lee, but then that's the same, I guess that's the same thing. Probably he was the master's favorite, and, you know, it's just a matter of seniority that he's not now the new master of the school, perhaps. I don't know. I mean, we accept it, right? That it's that what the hero's turn is supposed to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unusually, he gets a little bit of romance in this, which you don't see a lot in his films. You know, even like passionate kissing, which is rare even in Chinese films of the era at all. You don't see a lot of that. They're very demure about showing sexuality, let's say, to the point where in Enter the Dragon, we've got a lot of prostitutes, right? And none of them are Chinese, because you can't get Chinese actresses to play prostitutes.
Mm.
So you have to go and get real prostitutes to... Some of them might be Chinese, but I mean, you need to go get real prostitutes. And that's what they did. And Enter the Dragon, those are all real working girls, not actresses.
I had not known that.
Very often, that's why they will get actresses or even actual prostitutes from Thailand to cover those roles. And I've seen that very often. And it's been discussed in a lot of DVD commentaries that I've listened to, where that's not a proper thing that's to be seen on screen as a prostitute, even as an actress.
Yeah.
Is a loss of face.
You know, it's interesting. That's very similar to Indian cinema. There's no kissing on the mouth there too, because it's always they come into it and you never see like passionate kisses there too, because it was the actress. And once again, it's not the guy who gets shamed in this one, but the actress. Mm-hmm. would seem to be loose in her morals.
Right.
And so I remember my mom saying, oh yeah, they don't do that in Indian movies. I was like, what? And so...
And did you know that at the end, okay, well, I've already done the synopsis, so you know that Chen Zhen is killed, although historically, he probably escaped Shanghai. And in fact, there's the Return of Shang Zhen film with Donnie Yen in it, is a return to the city later on. So of course, he doesn't die, nor do we see him die on screen. Necessarily, but you know, the implication is strong. And that's Bruce Lee's idea. It's Bruce Lee who, knowing the script, needed Chen Zhen to pay for his crimes. So he asked for that to be written in. His character had to die because he'd compromised so much. You know, that was the end of that character. That's how that arc should end.
Well, and in a bit of interesting metafiction, it's that end sequence plays a role in the plot of Game of Death.
Right.
And that's the one where he's at the beginning of the movie is supposedly killed before he goes on his own sort of revenge spree, as it were, in Game of Death itself.
They steal that clip, right? That's how it goes, right? They actually steal clip right from out of Fist of Fury.
Yeah. Well, and I think also it's they even had it like the clip covers the they steal the clip, and it's a little bit of them, I think, behind the scenes of him like getting prepped for it too. And supposedly one of the guys had a loaded gun in it, which then, of course, mirrors tragically the death of his own son later, who will be killed by a prop gun during the filming of The Crow.
Yeah, there's a whole mythology. It's a whole bizarre set of circumstances that keep repeating. I can see why there's so much legend and around all of this, because the coincidences are kind of freaky.
You know, it very much so. Very much so. But yeah, although it's funny in that final sequence where he, you know, runs at the guns and you hear them blazing, which what a lift from Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. When that happened, I kept thinking, like, he just got everybody behind him killed too, because all of his friends are like standing right behind him when he dies in a hail of gunfire in front of them, you know, and unless his body is like stopping every one of those bullets.
Yeah, I had that same thought.
I was like, did he just end up like in his, once again, last moment of defiant rage, like
doom everyone,
get more of his friends hurt.
Yeah.
You know? So I, you know, I'm very much actually okay with him dying at the end of that for specifically that reason. Like he, you know, he has to pay a fairly, you know, he enacted a karmic debt, I feel, against the Japanese aggressors and, you know, the poisoners and the sort of the tormentors of his school and his friends throughout the movie. But, you know, by doing so, became their tormentor as well, in a way.
There's a strain of Hamlet in this. Accidental, but, you know, there's that sense of a tragedy of a dead father, poisoned, in fact, and of the prince.
The son coming home to find it out.
And basically destroying his whole world for revenge. And, you know, disguising himself and playing mad, you know, that whole idea. There's a bit of Hamlet in this that I don't think is on purpose, but there's definitely a sense of it.
I hadn't even thought of it until you just mentioned it. And I was just like, whoa, that's true. Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know.
Well, the history of the world is the death of fathers, right? So,
yeah. It's funny. I love this movie, and it's copying later down the line. Fist of Legend, I love. And, you know, as a movie, and, you know, that movie doesn't really come out without this movie coming out first. So it's almost because this spawned so many remakes is one of the things I love the most about it, because I've loved so many of the remakes. Yeah.
You're right. Fist of Legend is a superior film. It's better made. And Jet Li's level of action is, you know, obviously awesome.
Also, the Japanese are not uniformly treated. You know, there's a number of great... I mean, his love interest is basically a Japanese girl in that movie. And her, like, dad is someone who sort of, you know, very much, like, has a great deal of respect for him.
Yeah. It's a more textured film. Obviously made in the early 90s. So, obviously, it's a more modern film, and like I said, the Bruce Lee's films are not great cinematic achievements. I think his work in them is great, but the films themselves are very often made on the cheap, and that's true of Fist of Fury as well. But still, I think it's got a better overall script than many of the other films, and that's why I picked it. So best moves, let's go back to Enter the Dragon for a second. What are your favorite moves in that film?
Well, I know my favorite move is basically also your favorite move in that. It's the fighting without fighting.
Oh yeah, I love that.
If there's any sort of like true, I would say almost like the sort of the apotheosis of martial arts is the ability to like win a fight without a single blow. Once again, I've mentioned before that I studied Aikido, and one of the principles that they have, the founder of Aikido, Morihei Ueshiba, the O sensei, has a book called The Art of Peace. And one of the things he really states in it is that, like, as a martial artist, if you reach the point where you do come to blows, you've actually failed at the higher levels of martial arts. You know, you've not perceived the conflict ahead of time and diffused it before it truly becomes physical conflict.
The first chamber of Shaolin, basically.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, it's all spiritual, yeah.
Yeah, and he's obviously an impressive physical specimen and an accomplished martial artist, but it's that moment there that I feel is the biggest move. You know, it's, you know, that art of fighting without fighting. And, you know, it's, he showed the ultimate technique of at peace, you know, when he's at, you know, sort of in the Tao and at peace, you know, there's no claws can find purchase. You know, his opponent is defeated with guile rather than muscle.
If people don't know what we're talking about, it's on the junk, mm-hmm. Where he, some guy just comes up, you know, pre-tournament to call him out. And what's your move? What's your style? So Bruce Lee says, it's the art of fighting without fighting. And so, well, show me. Well, we can't fight here. There's no room to fight on the boat. So let's just go to that island over there. Let's just take a little dinghy and...
Oh, I believe as he says, we can take this boat.
And then the guy jumps in the boat and Bruce Lee just lets the boat out, you know, just unties the boat and sort of sinks the guy. He defeats him. That's he wins by fighting without fighting. So, that's my favorite move. Although if we're going for, like, the real physical stuff, I do like the bit where he's fighting with Robert Wall and he gets flipped. Like, Robert Wall grabs him by the foot and flips him. And on the coming back down, he kicks him in the face. It's like a controlled flip.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. Like, a fun little move.
I want to say Tekken, the Bruce Lee analog, has that move in the game Tekken. And, you know, that's another thing, too. I think we should – Street Fighter, Mortal Kombat, and Tekken, like the three big head-to-head
fighting games,
all have Bruce Lee analogs in them of some sort that look and are not – you know, they don't make a lot of, like, bones about it not looking exactly like, sounding like, and having the stance and moves of – basically Bruce Lee.
And Bruce Lee's been in his own video games. You know, he doesn't need... When I was a kid, I had a Commodore 64, and there was a Bruce Lee game, which was more like a side-scrolling... Well, not a side-scroller. It's like levels, you know, jump up and... So I played the hell out of that.
Yeah. You know, my other... I did have to say my other favorite move in that one is... It's not fancy, but it's in the O'Hara fight, too, where it's that leaping neck ribcage crush, which is kind of a signature move of his that he uses... Because once again, it's not just the move, it's that he really acts in that move, you know, with that look of like he's almost going to cry because he had to murder someone on his face from that sequence. But other than that, there's just a lot of just how powerful a lot of his moves are. I think in his fight with like Mr. Han, there's one where he kicks him. It's a kick to the side of the head and Mr. Han's kind of like up in the corner of the screen. So he sort of like vanishes off the side of the screen during that kick, and it's so fast and so hard that I'm like, did he just kill that actor? Because
eventually he does kill Han, the character, and that's a pretty, I think that's a fun choreography, you know, just that Han had thrown a spear through the wall, the mirrored wall, and that was a spinning wall to the Hall of Mirrors. You know, sometimes the spear is pointing towards you in the room, sometimes it's the shaft instead, mm-hmm. and that when it so happens that it's got the point, you know, they're on the side of the point, Han gets spiked on that, which is like a, you know, a strong finish move for the villain.
Yeah.
I also like the bit with the snake. The snake is fun. The you know, he grabs a cobra.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah.
And Bruce Lee got bit by that thing, you know. It had been devenomed, uh-huh. but he did get bitten because what he has to do is grab the snake, puts it in a bag, he stuffs him in a bag, and the whole, you know, it's a real snake. It's wrapping around his arm all the while. And then later on, he throws the snake into a guard booth, you know, so just to cause a distraction. But he needs to make the snake angry. So he's tapping the snake on the head just prior to throwing it into the box. So that's a real snake being tapped on the head to get it angry and to flare out its collar. That's when he got bit.
Rightly so.
Well, yeah. And that whole sequence in the caves, I mean, we'll talk about Fist of Fury in a second and its moves. And, you know, obviously there's Bruce Lee defeating a whole school in that. But in Enter the Dragon, he defeats, kills or defeats, I think it's 51 different guys or they're supposed to be all different guys. I think Jackie Chan bites it twice.
Yeah.
But the same people. But there are 51 goons that get defeated in that one sequence.
Yeah. And I mean, that's such a showcase of his weapon skills, because it's...
Oh, yeah.
He goes from the staff to the chucks to the Eskrima sticks, you know, courtesy of Denny and Asanto, his friend and collaborator, who we'll see again in Game of Death, who introduced the Eskrima sticks to him. And that is like, there's just a piles and piles of people he just takes out during that whole sequence. It's just amazing. So how about for Fist of Fury?
Well, Fist of Fury, there's some, obviously there's like big showcases, like fighting the whole school and all that. But there's things like in the final fight, there's a sword throw, mm-hmm. like the samurai sword gets flipped into the air and Bruce Lee grabs the guy and the sword transpierces him in the back.
Yes.
You know, and that's all she wrote. That's like, those are the kinds of clever, fun moves that I think are easy to circle. There's also the one that everybody knows because it's a popular GIF. The one where he uses his hands sort of to mesmerize.
Yeah.
So they use a sort of effect where I guess the person he's fighting is kind of already a bit KO'd, you know, kind of woozy. But it's his hands leaving an after image mm-hmm. as he, you know. So it looks like he's doing the snake in that one where he's, you know, mesmerizing with his hand gestures.
Yeah.
And that's something that you, I mean, it's, I know it's a GIF. I've seen it. Every so often.
Yeah, it's an iconic image of him, like, doing the sort of mystic hand moves in a way. For me, you know, the sword one, as we were thinking about this, it was the one where he sort of kicks the sword up and pulls the guy down and he gets stabbed with it. I did like it. But I gotta say, it's when he kills the cook.
Okay.
When he kills him with that single blow. In modern show movies now, they would have shown, like, an X-ray cutaway of everything inside that guy rupturing when he got hit. But you sense it. It's that one punch he gives to the guy's midsection, and you see that guy, you almost see him like bend, like he's a piece of metal that got that hit with a hammer really hard and just kind of fall over dead. And just the power of that blow, especially since, you know, Bruce Lee is famous for the one inch punch.
Right.
You know, the ability to knock a man over from, you know, several feet, and I've seen a film of him doing it in demonstrations, which how true it was, but I like to not be skeptical about Bruce Lee and his near superhuman abilities whenever possible, because I love the guy so much. But, you know, he, you know, so famously was a unbelievably powerful, and that just that idea that he could hit someone with a punch that was from an inch away and it would knock you over and knock you back multiple feet. It's something you see in there. It's that almost that idea of like that massive chi power that he has from his strength and his fury and how it translates. I remember watching it again when I watched the movie earlier, and it's just, you know, it's like you feel that hit almost watching it, which sometimes, you know, is not the case in a lot of kung fu movies. There's almost like, you know, the way they hit so quickly, you almost feel like it's, you know, in some ways, like he hits so quickly that it's like, it's almost like they're slaps.
That is why they have to slow down some of the action.
Yeah.
I know famously in The Big Boss, they had to slow down the action because you could not see some of the blows. He was so fast. And it was like the first film. So there's a real valid reason for him to be shirtless in these films, mm-hmm. because there is no one of that size who has more defined muscles.
Oh, yeah. He's swole.
He looks like a piece of wood, a carved piece of wood that can somehow move. He's not bulky at all.
No.
But every muscle is defined, and you can see the muscles. You know, when I heard he died at 32 and wasn't too sure of the circumstances of his death, in my mind, it was like, you know, he was so wound up.
Yeah.
He was so tightly wound that he essentially gave himself a heart attack. From his own intensity. That's how I, obviously it was something else, but that was the conclusion I jumped to. Because, you know, how else someone in such health and physical fitness could die at that age, you know?
Yeah. And I think that's also a lot of what fueled the idea of, like, you know, he was killed by a secret technique or something like that. Although to point out, you know, if Jason Lee, who plays him as in the biopic Dragon, there's the sequence in that movie where he has that sort of secret fight with the Chinese champion, because he's been teaching non-white or non-Chinese kung fu, and he's been forbidden to do it. And so there's very like secret society battle he has where he gets kicked in the back and it basically puts him in traction and he's wheelchair bound for it. And they're basically saying he won't walk again. He actually sustained that injury during exercising. He was basically so strong that he hurt himself while doing this sort of like jumping stretch exercise that he did and injured his back. And at the time he was told he would not walk again because of the severity of his injury. But, you know, once again, it's that sort of back to that mystique of the sort of almost quasi mysticalness of the martial arts, you know, then the sort of vitalism of Chi that he built himself back up and became even more of a physical specimen. I mean, you can see it the most by Enter the Dragon. When he's shirtless in Enter the Dragon, it's just that guy is like, there's not an unnecessary gram of fat on that guy. And if it's not whipcord fast and strong muscle, I don't know what it is that he's made of at that point.
And yet for all that, I think what I would consider as perhaps the move of the week is actually the move that he does in both films that we picked. Because the whole idea of using the nunchucks, which are not a Chinese weapon.
No, it's a Japanese weapon.
The idea of using those nunchucks and the way he does, sure, it's, you know, he beats up people with it, but it's more about intimidating. It becomes such an intimidating weapon in his hands. The classic pose where he's got the, he's just flipped the nunchucks a few times and then he's got the nunchucks under his arm and his other hand stretched out towards the opponent. That whole thing is the number of goons who sort of back away at that point, who are afraid of the weapon.
Yeah.
Which is a short reach weapon. It should not be difficult for a man with a samurai sword, such as in Fist of Fury, to defeat someone with nunchucks. It's got a different reach entirely. And even Bruce Lee admitted to that in interviews that, you know, normally, yeah, the guy with the sword would have the advantage.
Yeah.
But not in the film.
Yeah.
So I think that that's probably because it's a signature move that repeats across these films.
Well, it's his signature weapon on all of his. I don't think. Does he have a movie where he doesn't use the nunchucks?
I don't know about The Big Boss. And of course, the films where he's only partially in them, like Game of Death, I'm not too clear. It's for sure in Way of the Dragon.
Yeah.
So he tends to use it in most. I mean, it's the one that he uses for demonstration, basically. It's always a big showpiece. And it's also kind of, they find a way to justify it, even though it's a bit like, it's not always well justified, but it has to happen because it's a Bruce Lee film. So yeah. So to me, that would be the move of the week, especially since we're covering Bruce Lee specifically.
Oh yeah. No, it's definitely, I mean, it's even on the movie poster for Enter the Dragon. He's in the background looming large in that movie poster with his arms outstretched and nunchucks like stretched between his hands. If you look at many of the movie posters for it.
I'm looking at it right now on the DVD box, the old classic poster, and you got Jim Kelly behind him with the hand outstretched as if he had been using the nunchucks. You know, it evokes that pose as well, even though it's with another character. To me, that's the, I don't know if you agree, but that to me would be the move of the week.
Oh, yeah. He's the one who brings that, the nunchuck to the, you know, at the very least in the U.S. mindset, you know. As a viable weapon, I think he's the one who kind of brings that into that sort of zeitgeist.
Let's talk recommendations, because not that many films to recommend this time around. Bruce Lee was taken from us before he could make truly great pictures, which is the greatest shame here. What would be your recommendation as far as Bruce Lee films go that we haven't covered here?
I would have to say Way of the Dragon. I think the fight sequence with Chuck Norris, I mean, aside from that, it would be Chuck Norris's like opening vehicle into film. It's got location in the fact that it's one of the first ones outside of Asia that he films. Actually, the only one he films outside of Asia. It's not just that he fights Bruce Lee, but he fights Bruce Lee at the Colosseum of all places too. And we see too, like in that movie, his, you know, what I, if we were reviewing that movie, I would call his signature move the chest hair tear. As the thing I always remember from that movie is fight. That's probably one of them. I would have other recommendations, but they're not Bruce Lee movies, though, necessarily. I recommend Dragon. As a biopic movie, they definitely take their liberties with a lot of the story, and they do lean heavily into this idea of there being like this almost like demon or curse that follows them. But I feel Jason Lee very much captures the spirit of Bruce Lee the man in that movie, And it has some really great fight sequences in it that are well done, well shot, and well choreographed. There's a fight sequence that is supposed to occur during, I don't remember if it's Chinese. See, it's this naming convention that just throws me all the time. It's the Ice House fight that he has, which...
The Big Boss.
You know, yeah. Big Boss, yeah. Which, you know, we see that in the movie, but then he's, you know, in Dragon, he has apparently like a real true fight with a person who's come after him for revenge for something he did in the real world. You know, that sequence is amazing in it too. And you get to see, you know, you get this idea of like, you know, this wasn't just like, oh, he does it for show. You know, if push comes to shove, this guy could fight for real. I would recommend that. And then I would definitely recommend Fist of Legend. Watch Fist of Fury, but then watch Fist of Legend. It very much is the better version of that movie.
Yep. I would agree with that.
Yeah. So, those would be my recommendations.
Well, you recommended everything that I might have, but, well, if we're recommending Fist of Legend, I do recommend the sequel to Fist of Fury, which is The Return of Shenzhen, Legend of the Fist.
Donnie Yen, right?
Yeah, it's Donnie Yen, so it's pretty awesome. And there's even like bits where Shenzhen is kind of dressed as Kato. So it really does pay tribute to Bruce Lee in this and Bruce Lee's career. And it's a great film. Very fun. So there's that.
Of all the sort of Asian martial arts actors we've discussed, Donnie Yen has like some of the best acting chops too.
And we will, we'll do an episode just on Donnie.
Yeah.
Eventually, because he's my favorite modern Kung Fu star. But if I'm going to name a Bruce Lee flick that we haven't, I will sort of ironically recommend Game of Death,
mm-hmm.
because it is the last, you know, last few bits of Bruce Lee that we get. Mm-hmm. So the end sequence features a number of fights. Bruce Lee is, of course, good in that. But for most of the film, he's not available. He's died. So they go and use all sorts of tricks to make Bruce Lee be in the film. And just on that level and the balls it took to do that, I think it's worth recommending. It goes from using clips from other films, using home movies of Bruce Lee. The bit where I would say is creepy and they shouldn't have done that is using footage from his real funeral.
Yeah.
That's the icky part. And that's the bit that I wish wasn't in there. But there's also having, you know, doubles, scarring his face so that somebody can just wear some sort of mask or makeup and still say it's Bruce Lee. But they've also got this part where they just stuck a picture of Bruce Lee's face on somebody else's face, like a flat picture.
Oof.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so just the idea of how did they accomplished it, and sometimes badly, I think is worth it for fans of kitsch and B-movie stuff. So how do you take 20 minutes of Bruce Lee footage and still make a film out of it?
Yeah.
Is interesting. So no, and if you're getting that box set, if you're getting the box set with Fist of Fury, Big Boss, Way of the Dragon, you'll get both Game of Death and Game of Death 2, which is has even less Bruce Lee in it, but it's really about someone else who goes in his footsteps. So you get all of those films. So if you know, it's not a good film, it's very much a bad one, but it's interesting on a filmmaker kind of level. So I would recommend it with some irony.
And the thing of it, too, is like as we talk about sort of like the iconography of Bruce Lee, it's the yellow jumpsuit. I mean, this is the yellow, you know, if we're talking about the Bruce Lee action figure line, it's the yellow jumpsuit, Bruce Lee.
Yeah. The one from Kill Bill as well.
Yes. Kill Bill, you know, very much so. You know, I have a it's not a Bruce Lee movie that he acts in, but he had worked on the story for Circle of Iron. I would actually recommend as a sort of Bruce Lee tangential movie, mainly because he did work on it. But that one I feel is it's a very much a martial arts fantasy movie, but has a deep, very deep, like philosophical story behind it. But you see his influences throughout it too, and starring David Carradine, and was written with two of his friends, James Coburn and Sterling Siliphant, who were both also his students as well. Something that was important. So I always recommend that as well as a sort of like, you know, he's not in it. His credits are really only in the story itself. But in my lexicon, when I think of Bruce Lee movies, I also think of this movie as well.
For completists.
Yes.
Well, that's all the time we have, folks. But come back next time for more crazy kung fu action. I think the next episode will be Jackie Chan.
Ooh.
Thanks for spending this time with me, Dr. G.
Oh, of course. Of course. It was, as Mr. Han would say, you have our gratitude.
And since we do enjoy reading your comments, a reminder that the best place for that is fireandwaterpodcast.com, or you can visit the Fire and Water Podcast Network on Facebook. Or tag us on Twitter using the hashtag FWPodcast. Find my other work at the Fire and Water Podcast Network and Dr. G's at Pulp to Pixels Podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
Until then, be water, my friends.
Be water.